Welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, bringing the tales and stories of the ancient Celts to your fireside. Special episode number 14, Autumn Equinox 2009. Hello, I'm Gary, and welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show.
Yes, hello. I'm Ruth. This is the holiday special show for the autumn equinox, or Alban Elvid, in 2009. We have a real treat for you in this show.
Oh, yes, we do. Our main feature is a recording of a talk given by Professor Dr. Roland Rotherham, entitled The Ladies of the Grail. And what a wonderful talk it is.
It certainly is. It's just over an hour long, so we'll take a break halfway through so that you can split the show in two, if you need to, and leave all the contact details till the very end. So, do we have anything else in the show? You know, stories or anything?
No? Well, I've kind of tried to trim it down, because otherwise it's going to be huge, well, but we've still got three pieces of great Arthurian music to get us in the mood.
Brilliant. So, what have you got to start us off?
Well, Roland is going to talk about the Ladies of the Grail. So let's leap into action with Morgana by Kellyanna, which is about Morgan le Fay.
Babylon, ancient wisdom, Lady Morgane of the fairies, will you be lost again in the other world? So many days, so many nights, no sense of place, no sense of time, oh Morgana. So many days, so many nights, no sense of place, no sense of time, oh Morgana. Morgan le Fay, born of kings and queens, ancient powers and ancient mysteries, the fairy people, they were her kin, and when she lost her way, they would take her in. So many days, so many nights, no sense of place, no sense of time, oh Morgana. So many days, so many nights, no sense of place, no sense of time, oh Morgana.
Song. And when I listen to it, it always reminds me of the Mists of Avalon.
Oh, yes.
Always, always. Fabulous song. That song was Morgana by Kellyanna from her album Lady Moon. And well worth a listen to the whole album. Fabulous stuff.
Yeah, one of my favourites.
So anyway, tell us about the talk.
Okay. This talk was recorded on the 11th of July at the Andera de Gorseth Conference, which was organised by our friends Dave the Bard and Kerry Lee. And we'd like to offer our deep and lasting gratitude to them and to Roland for allowing us to bring you this wonderful talk.
And here's a little background on Roland. Dr. Roland Rotherham holds degrees in Ancient and Medieval Studies, Anglo-Saxon Culture, Heraldry, Anglo-Norman Culture, ancient and medieval cultural studies and education.
Good grief. What an amazing background.
Oh, he's certainly an amazing man. And what a wonderful personality. Let's have a listen to the first half of his lecture.
Yeah.
Talk this afternoon is on the Ladies of the Grail. Can you hear me up there?
Yes.
Yeah? Why aren't you sitting down here? Honestly, the chairs all over the place empty, but no, I don't project my voice up to you. I am constantly annoyed. I know where you live. By people who automatically assume that the heroes of the Grail legends are the knights.
You fool.
Quiet, child! Whenever we look at the legends, you've got Galahad, dear old Galahad, the Red Cross Knight. My strength is as of the strength of 10, or my heart is pure. Slap it so much. You've got Percival, the perfect fool, this epitome of naivety who manages to attain the Grail. More by luck than any type of good judgment. You've got the Welsh legends of Peredur, but, and don't shout out, put your hands up, how many of you knew that Gawain attained the Grail?
Oh, I see, oh, I knew.
The story of Gawain attaining the Grail is one of the most obscure in the ancient legends. And we'll be coming to that because I've got a copy.
Ooh, have you?
The story of the female aspect in the Grail legend is literally thousands of years old. And the very first time you see it is actually on the temple walls, well, actually it's the tomb walls of the little burial temple that was built into the tomb of Queen Hatshepsut, who, as you all know, was a mint from Cairo. When you actually read the inscriptions on the wall and see these wonderful figures, you see Osiris seated in majesty. Incredible sort of colour that Osiris has here, sort of two bigger names here. And in front stands Hatshepsut. She's just been judged. So the crocodile god is there. He needn't wait anymore. Her heart and her sins have been found lighter than the feather. Anubis has attended to. I'm having that done, by the way. Tell my local vicar, when I go, he's going to do the full business, the Anubis mask. Well, look, the Church of England says it wants to go forward, let it go forward. And behind stands a young lady. It's Nephthys. And Nephthys is holding a platter. And this platter is full, and it looks red. And this is the divine blood, as it states in the hieroglyphs underneath. And standing behind Nephthys is her sister, Isis, who is actually holding a spear that actually has blood trickling from the tip. This is the very earliest evidence that I have found yet so far of a grail and a bleeding spear existing in history or in historical legend and belief. Now, there's no doubt it's much older than that, but this is the earliest I've got. I can't stress enough the importance of some of these early Egyptian tales on our later cultural beliefs. I mean, everybody sort of goes ooh-ah at Easter time when they see Robert Powell getting nailed up again. Oh, I get sick of it, I really. I think he's a bloody good number four bat, though. He really is. I played with him a couple of times. He's all right, I tell you. And Simon, I saw his wife last time. I realized that the last time I saw him, it was Mad Dog Baby. You know, what was her name? From Pam's People.
Mrs. Pam.
Babs! That's it, that's her. Yeah, she's awfully pretty. God, they couldn't dance then, could they? Never mind. Anyway, this whole idea of this grail and the female aspect of it. Let's look at Osiris. What's happened to him? He's been done in, he's been chopped up. Who's putting that together again? Isis. Either his wife, his sister, or my. Jim Mikhail showed us waiting. Sticks him all back together. What's missing? The important bit. I know, she says, I'll make one out of wood. You would have think that, wouldn't you? And I just thought, you know, Jim, God, you know, I hope they had sandpaper in Egypt. Anyway. Miraculous! Birth of Horus afterwards. Well, it would be miraculous, wouldn't it, really? I mean, but then again, you look what happens with. And then we end up again with more female influence in the story, with Nephthys, the sister, down the Nile a bit. She gives birth to a wee bairn, wraps it up in cloth, sticks it in the little boat, shoves it down the Nile, down it goes into the bulrushes. Oh, says Isis, how lovely, I'll bring it up as my own, you know. Talk about revisory beats. The female element in the stories is vital. I am coming round to the opinion that in at least 80% of what we've been reading throughout history, and do any of you, by any chance, go into Paul's podcast? Why did I get this podcast for you? I was like, what is a podcast? He said, will you do a podcast? And I said, well, of course I will. I've got the faintest bloody idea what it is. It's on your website or something, and you can listen to it. You actually hear something I was talking about last night, which I called the fallacy of the crucifixion, which, they're waiting for me outside. Stick an apple in your mouth and turn me around when I'm done, you know. Because of the interference of the early churches, and this, let's face it, it's misogynistic, to say the least. You've ended up with so many of these great legends and rites being downplayed as far as the woman's part's concerned. I am convinced that we are looking at a good 80% that has got to be Really? I'm absolutely positive about it. Now, do remember that that which I speak of now, this is my personal opinion. Tomorrow we could find something buried somewhere and it could change it all again, and we'll find that Galahad was right and I've been barking up the wrong tree for the rest of my life, in which case I will donate what's left of it to medical science and the consumption of brandy. And I've had a bloody good try at that over the last couple of years. Our whole belief in the Grail, I'm not going to call it the Holy Grail. That's, you know, I'll leave that to you and Monty Python. But the Grail, this vessel, whatever it is, dish, plate, cup, doesn't matter. Woman, not bothered. Couldn't care less. It's supposedly something that's lost, that's got to be searched for. But if you look at all the different variations of these stories, it drives you soft. They can't all be right. Fair enough. One of our earliest in this country, you actually get in the Babylon. Now, I love the Babylon. You've all read it, haven't you? Put your hands up if you haven't. You'll learn. The Babylonian, and literally, if you're looking for the best translation, look for Lady Charlotte Guest. That's an absolutely superb translation. Lady Charlotte Guest. She was the widow of the widow of her husband. I've not been well. He was the guest of Guest Keen Nettlefold, GKN, the engineering people. And she actually ran the company, which through the Victorian years, absolutely unknown. But she actually translated the Mabinogion, did a brilliant job of it. Absolutely superb. So go, yes?
Can you give us a very potted version of I know it's lovely and it's long and it's big, but can you just give us a concise...
Yeah, two heroes, two women, off on a jaunt, castle, appears from nowhere, woman goes in, oh look, bowl hanging down, tripod, touch, all of a sudden she can't move, castle vanishes. Next thing you know, a year later, walking round again, bloke says, go look for a woman, goes in, there she is, stuck, can't touch it. He reaches up, grab hold of bowl, stuck, castle vanishes again, two of them left, oh bloody buggery, what's going on? Year later, in they go again, free them both, take the bowl, castle. It's the old vanishing Celtic castle trick. Grail castle. There's about 70 pages in that.
See, I'm glad you're telling me I don't have to read it.
Josh! You have that. And, of course, at the very beginning of it, you have the stories of Kiluch and Orwen. Now, this is the one that I like. This is the one that a very noble gentleman is going to elucidate even further in his next talk, when it talks about Evnissia from the Mabinogion. There's a wonderful story in there where you have two brothers and their sister. Their sister is betrothed to King Matholoch of Ireland, or Mickrick, as it is. Her father is the wonderful Bendigeidfran, Bran the Blessed, as opposed to Brian the Blessed, who is a dead brother. Bran the Blessed. Misunderstandings. Oh, he's beating me, is he really? Yes, well, we'll come and have a war. Goes over, King Matholoch, bang, in the backside. Bran the Blessed. Oh, cripes, can't move, somebody's hurt me. Got me where it shouldn't. Tell you what, cut my head off, pop it on a plate, as you would, like a military buffet. Take me back home into the hall. I will keep you company as long as nobody opens the door of the window and looks out at what's going on. So, they cut off his head, stick it on a dish, and there in the hall, everything that they require, all that they most want to eat and drink, supplied for. This is the premise of a true grail. This is the old Celtic belief in the great communal pot that would not cook the food of the coward, and would only provide the portion for the hero. This head on this platter, this plays one of the most singularly important roles in the Grail saga we've got. But so far in that story, it's blokes, warriors. Okay, it's a king. Ah, something more to it than that. Now, our first glimpse of the classic Grail procession is one of the strangest things you will ever see. Supposedly, Percival is sitting by the Fisher King, Amfortas. Fisher King, all he can do is lie in his boat and fish. Again, he's been wounded by a spear in the groin, which is rendered in illness. It's the only thing. Again, we're going back to the Great Rite, where the king, priest, etc., prince, performs the Great Rite with the queen, princess, priestess each year. It makes sure that the land is fruitful. If he gets smacked in the danglers, I'm sorry, but that's not going to happen. He can no longer function as a king. Hence, Bran saying, cut my head off. The rest useless. Stick my head down, I'll tell you jokes. It was only an important, etc. But the procession that Percival sees when he sits next to Amfortas, the Grail King, as the Grail King lounges languidly, doing his no coward on a couch, I mean. Percival sits on the side. Something strange happens. When no one's expecting it, apart from Amfortas, because he sees it every day, all of a sudden, the door opens in the side. And? Oh, yes, you!
Cheers.
Oh, that's funny, I haven't got all day. A young lady bearing a... bearing a mystic vessel. Yeah. Appears from the side entrance. Now, not only is there a young lady bearing this vessel, but behind the young lady is another young lady. Would you draw it for me? No, you. I'm not sexist. And this young lady with long flowing golden locks carries a spear. And from this spear, blood pours down from the tip, down the shaft, to the hand. Behind that young lady is another young lady who has a fabulously jeweled plate. And on it appears a head. Now, I want you to stand here. And I'd like you to stand there. And perhaps you could stand there. Face that. As soon as they leave the door, they process slowly in front of the court, and in front of Percival, and in front of Amfortas the king. They process slowly in front of the court. Amfortas lies there, thinking, go on, say it. Percival says, exactly, sweet Felicity Arkwright. Let's hear it for our nubile bevy. They
there he is, going before them. A cup of incredible wrought work.
He carried along a green glow emanating from it.
Behind,
a sphere that bleeds all by itself. Behind that, this incredible large jeweled dish with the head sitting on it.
What is the classical question that you're supposed to ask of the grail?
Whom does it serve?
Whom doth the grail serve?
You're getting better, aren't you?
Whom doth the grail serve? Is that it? Is that it? No! You're not telling me that there isn't another two questions waiting to be asked there. Whom doth the grail serve? Who drinks from that cup? Great, okay, fine. It's a cup. Nice glow coming from it. Whom doth the grail serve? Excuse me. You've got a spear. See, I can't tell you to mind my own business if you like. But it does seem to be bleeding of its own accord. Yeah? Perhaps you might like to. And then, hold it. Who is that? I've got a cup. I've got a bleeding spear. And now I've got a dish that winks at me as no. There have been a lot of changes taking place here. A lot of changes in this tradition, in this procession. They've cut out in legend nearly all of these questions that you've got to ask, because they're only for those that really know the answer in the first place. Reportedly, supposedly. No! We've had a procession of three young ladies who've gone slowly before your gaze to reveal these mysteries. Why, if it's so important, have not more people heard of Gawain attaining the grail? Well, let me tell you. According to the story, Gawain, two of his companions, end up in the castle of the grail, and the procession goes in front of him. Before the procession starts, have a drink, says the grail. Cheers, say the boys. Have something to eat, says the grail. Thanks, say the lads. So they're tucking in, they're having a cup. All of a sudden, the door opens. Amphitas lies there. The procession goes past. Two companions, blotto. Gawain, ripped. Three sheets. Cut. He wakes up in the morning, castle gone. He recognizes the cup, manages to say something about it. Oh yes, he's obtained the cup. What about the spear? What about the dish with the head on? Wakes up, castle gone. Vanished castle. Grail castles disappear all the time. Left in its place, group of women. One of them at the front, they're boys, woman. And he walks up and says, where has the castle gone? Says the wise woman, which is not that wise. And all the people go walking past him, saying, thanks for the cup, retain the grail. Twice cursed be you now. Hold on, says Gawain. He says, oh, I've got the cup. Come on, we've obtained this. Oh, yes, yes, we've got a bit back. Oh, look, it was a dandelion growing. It's sunny, I suppose. You can make dandelion root coffee. But the rest of it is still arid. The rest of it is still wasteland. And in the text, it actually says, once blessed, twice cursed, for it was not fulfilled. The spear and the platter, nowhere to be seen. Now, plea of the lightning spear smashes the haft onto the ground, thunderbolts flash everywhere, lightning crashes across the world. What has to happen to that spear at the end of every day? Poor new livers.
We've had the blood, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Your prior is good. Fed with blood in a ditch. What's your name?
Daniel.
Daniel! Ah, good. That's not for Daniel. You're not him, though. Where do you normally reside?
Hamburg, sir.
Hamburg?
Yes.
Oh, excellent. My family live in Berlin.
All right.
Yes, just across the bay, sir.
Just love the fucking.
Well, maybe you give me one of
those.
Sit down. There is a jar that is filled with old blood, and the spear must be stood in it. If it is not placed in this vessel that holds the blood, the spear is not controlled. Goes out on a wild killing spree. Could you nudge your friend in the bed? You are with us, it's all right. You're not sending a text, are you? That would have resulted in great pain. The Grail is the controlling element of the other elements of the Grail. It is the control. Without it, who knows what this spear is doing? The spear supposedly has a life of its own. It goes out performing the most vile acts so that it is fed with blood. It must this blood. If any of you were interested, I've actually got a couple of papers that I've written on this. Plus, I've actually got the illustrations. What do you call them? High definitions?
I don't know what it means.
Yes. Big pictures of the Spear of Destiny when they actually took it apart in the Kunsthistorische Museum in Vienna. And if any of you send me an email and ask, I'll gladly send it down to you. As long as you don't publish them or use them for anything naughty, right? You can have them if you want. The Grail, this bowl, dish, vase, cup, whatever, that holds this blood, this control, is the cooling, soothing element of the other elements that take part in the procession. It is the female to the male. It is the moon to the sun. We were always told in the ancient sagas that the moon had a dish she bathed in, and the sun had a spear that he carried in his chariot. This is the male and female elements, the balance. It isn't the only time we'll come across this. Ooh, I hear you say.
Ooh.
Just be quicker. Gawain, when he's entering the castle of Corbeny, that's interesting. Have all of you been to Dinas Brân at Llangollen? Hands up if you have. There's a few of you make the journey to Dinas Brân at Llangollen. That is the castle. Would you mind joining me for just a minute? could stand in that corner.
Will you beat me? Text my mum.
Shut to the polls.
Wow. I was recording this while you were helping out at the conference, and I was silently laughing so hard that my sides hurt. I was.
I really do wish I'd seen him.
I couldn't let any laughter go into the microphone.
Well, no, of course. Of course. I really wish I'd seen him.
So, what piece of music do we have in the intermission?
Well, talking about Knights of the Round Table, have a listen to Many a Night by the beautiful and talented Kim Thompson.
Here in my room, a shuttle plays on loom, past day's events come clear. Here on my own, my weariness has flown, how I wish he were near. Calls in his mane, the archer set his aim, his arrow.
Was Many a Night by Kim Thompson from her early album Urban Dryad, which you can still hear on Last FM. Thank you so much, Kim.
Yes, thank you, Kim.
All of the details for hearing this album are in our show notes.
And now, let's get back to the lecture hall to catch up with the second half of Roland's lecture about the Ladies of the Grail.
Dinas Bran. Ecco Bran the number of things. Dinas Bran, the mountain of Bran, the mountain of Bran, yes, Bendigai Bran. The castle itself, the castle of Bran. Also the castle of the raven. The raven is the sacred bird of Bran. Right, it is the sacred bird of Odin, Allfather. Okay, so this is the Grail Castle of Britain. Okay, it's well worth it. It's a good climb. It is not an easy walk up. But when you get there, you know there's something about that site. It is fabulous. And you get an unparalleled view of the Dee Valley, which is one of the most glorious sights in the whole of Britain. Wales is a particularly beautiful country, and I'm passionately fond of it. While you're there, you also go, just about a mile down the road, to Valle Crucis Abbey, where an olive wood bowl was kept after the dissolution of the monasteries in England. And that could be the bowl of St. Joseph of Arimathea. And almost next door to that, there is the Pillar of Elise. And on the Pillar of Elise were carvings made which purportedly show the family tree of Owain Llanfwen, who may have been the warlord who people call the Arthur. So this area around Llangollen is absolutely brimful of the things that make us live. And apart from that, by the car park, there is a little cafe. It does the finest barabrith I've ever had. Are you comfortable? Would you like to get
No. I've got a better view here.
This wonderful Welsh connection is echoed in one of the later stories of Gawain entering the castle of Corbenic. Corbenic is at the heights of the city. He enters the city, and all of a sudden there are people rushing round, crying and moaning. Then nobody stops to talk to him.
A bit further on, he hears,
"Won't somebody help me?" And he goes rushing into a house. There's a bathroom. And there's a woman sitting in the bath. He said, "What's wrong?" She said, "I can't get out of the bath." He thinks, "I've got a toe stuck in the plug hole or something like that." So he walks over. He said, "Well, come on." He said, "I'll lift you, we can't." He said, "Well, can't you get yourself out?" She said, "No." He sticks his hand in the bath water, and according to the text, it actually says, "Whereof it was so hot that my pain could not bear it, and pulled out the hand and arm, leaving the woman sick." So, for some strange reason, known only to those that put Grail legends together, this strange woman has appeared in the story, sitting in a hot bath that she can't get out of. Now, how does this link in with the rest of the Grail story? It doesn't. For some weird and wonderful reason, some wet nymph has been plunged into a boiling bath, told to stay there and not get out, and it bears absolutely no bearing on the rest of the story whatsoever. Gawain, this almost successful Grail Knight, quite incredible, gets so close, only to have it whipped away. But again, the female element of it is so strange. They crop up doing the weirdest and most wonderful things. At the very beginning of the story, there is a lady who enters the scene on a palfrey. Now, everybody thinks you have a palfrey horse. It isn't actually. It's actually a palfrey saddle that goes on a horse. And the horse becomes known as the palfrey. There's an area in Warsaw called Palfrey where they used to make those medieval saddles. It's quite astonishing. But right by the side of her, she says nothing. But walking in on the scene, oh, as a little dwarf. Ah! That's got your attention, hasn't it? If you see a dwarf arrive in a story, or an animal that is a different colour to what it's supposed to be, you know something's going to happen, don't you? Always something is going to happen. And in the legend it states, this dwarf, though fair of countenance, was hideous within and of foul mouth. Well, it's obviously French. And he sets the ball rolling for Gawain's encounters. But, and this is, oh, I've got to be honest with you, I'm going to indulge myself now. I know. They said they wouldn't prosecute if I didn't do it again. Do all of you know in Birmingham Art Gallery and Museum, when they come out, the Holy Grail tapestries by Edward Burne-Jones? I think probably nearly all of you must have seen those, haven't you? Let me get a rough idea. Hands up if you have seen. Oh, for crying out loud!
We're here so you can educate us while we're... That's why we've come.
Well, they've just gone back in again for another 4 years. They are a series of tapestries that were designed by the Pre-Raphaelites, and they were executed by Edward Burne-Jones and William Morris in the tapestry workshops at Mortlake. Others helped with the design, people like Bending, Gabriel Rossetti, Holman Hunt. They are the most incredible workings I have ever seen in my life, and I've been to Bristol. They are just amazing. You start off with the first tapestry, and they're big. I mean, you know, these things are easily the size of these apertures in the wall here. They really are, they're huge. In fact, the attaining of the Grail is the biggest of them all. The first one shows Arthur and his knights seated at the round table, and by him is the Siege Perilous, because Galahad and or Percival, depending on the version, hasn't appeared yet. So. And all of a sudden, the maiden appears and tells of the Grail that is to come in, the quest that must be taken on. And then the next one is called the Arming. Now, the Arming shows the knights getting ready to ride out. And the knight at the foreground is Lancelot, and behind him is Bors and Galahad and all the others. And it says in the official introduction, the virgin maidens of Camelot do assist their knights for the Arming. Okay, well, the one on the left is Guinevere, so I'm sorry, you know, we're going to kick that one right out the window to start with. Do you know, Arthur married three queens called Guinevere. I thought it was two, we found the third one. All different, all called Guinevere. Now there's an intelligent man. A dear friend of mine in Lichfield, when he got married the second time, not only did his wife have the same first name, but they had the same birthday! Oh dear, how many did he have to interview? Anyway! This tapestry, the army, is beautiful. There's one maid who stands at the front, and she holds the helmet for Boris. And obviously, when they actually make these tapestries, there are hundreds of drawings made, to start with. Hundreds of drawings. I've got to be honest with you, I'm going to be perfectly frank, I'm probably the luckiest man in Christendom. Because one of those drawings that becomes this female holding this helmet I've actually got at home, I'm passionately proud of that. It's my treasure. And I look at this creature, the Burne-Jones drawing, and it's incredible that which she becomes. You have a tapestry then called the Verger. The Verger, the greenery as opposed to the Verger, who of course is much too busy for that time. Showing the shields of the knights and what their arms are. There is one small one showing the ship. Now you remember in the story the ship carries the knights to the fabled city of Sargos. But it's not quite like that. When they appear in legends, or when you see them on tapestries, ships are more than that. They are a doorway from one dimension to another. They actually open gateways and take you through. Ships are magical things. Why do you think that a ship is included in the Mists of Avalon? That in, which I have maintained to everybody that asked, I was asked on a chat show, there was a number of us on. I said that, you know, that to my mind is the greatest Arthurian book of the 20th century. But nothing can take away the value of that volume. It's tremendous. But the way that the boat goes through the mists, and depending on your headset, I'll say mindset, because otherwise you automatically think of the ladies of Avalon with iPods. Depending on your mindset, you will either land on the shores of the abbey or the side of the tor where the encampment is, the mystical encampment. This is wondrous stuff. This is what keeps our hearts beating. This is tremendous. How the bloody hell did I get onto that? Ah, yes! Yes! The ship. But the next one, the final one, that is the attainment. Now that is something else, because there you see outside Lancelot kneeling down, because he's a goody goody, and is trying to be forgiven for whopping it off with the king's missus. Behind him, that's an academic term, by the way, whopping. Behind him stands Sir Bors. Remember, he too is not completely without sin. They're almost good enough, but not quite. Standing by the doorway, and this is the interesting bit, are angels. Now, the thing I love about the Pre-Raphaelites is they do angels justice. They are neither male nor female. They are merely angelic. Although, for the one who's holding this item, I'm going to come to in a second, they did use the beautiful Fanny Cornforth. Now, she was the raving beauty of the age. And you actually see some of the illustrations showing Fanny Cornforth and the hair. I mean, only Pre-Raphaelites could paint hair. And only Pre-Raphaelites knew how to paint auburn hair. I mean, they always used to say, only Rembrandt could paint hands and candlelight. The Pre-Raphaelites paint hair and auburn hair. You've all seen that incredible painting of the Lady of Shalott. I just sit there in the gallery and I look at that for hours. Yeah, I've been prosecuted twice. They are stunning visuals. There are two angels holding lighted tapers. But the next one in, for the door, holds the spear. And the spear drips blood down the hand of the angel, down the half. Look through the doorway, and there's Galahad.
I made it.
Kneeling down, and on the altar, with angels at the back, is the cup. But they're almost together. Almost together, but you know that something's gone wrong because they're still separated, the cup and the spear. But the beauty is that next time you come across the procession, the spear isn't there, the cup is, and so is the platter, carried by the ladies of the grail. This is the beauty. Always, the onus ends up getting fixed on the female. Because it's got to. It has to. That's where the onus lies. The lady is the controlling influence of the masculine. You know it's true. You know I'm telling the truth. Come on! Don't sit there trying to look. Oh, yes, all right. All right. You know I'm telling you the truth. We have in the story of Parsifal, which is one of my favorites. Parsifal This is the one written down by Wolfgang von Eschenbach. Incredible 10th century tale. You actually come across Parsifal, the way, who has a half-brother, Firefields. Firefields is half-Saracen. Now, here's an interesting thing, and this is lovely. This is why I like medieval literature so much. We know that there was a young lady named Starkey. Don't we? Yes? But how are they going to tell this in medieval terms? You look at a picture of Firefields. He's piebald. Black and white splotches. Of course, he's half white and half Saracen. So they show him exactly that. They don't. The subtlety of the colour doesn't come into it. I mean, all right, we saw all brown, so, oh, yes, stuff and butter. He's blotched. And that's the way they show him. But what about the lady? Réponse de Chauve. Réponse de Chauve, the lady guardian. Now she comes into the scene here. Oh, she's incredible. She's actually been identified with the Sophia, the gnosis, the wisdom. But she is the guardian of this incredible thing. Now, unfortunately, it states that through her knowledge, through her wisdom, and yet all the years of care and misfortune, her looks have not been kept. I'm sorry, I would rather have lovely grail maidens. This is what you expect to see in images. But here's something else, and I was half expecting this. I was half expecting this, because she has two handmaidens. One of whom is a mother, and one of whom is a child. Here I am looking at the three witches. I am looking at the Fates. I am looking at Valkyrie. I am looking at the three ages of woman. I am looking at the three faces of the goddess. I am looking from child to mother to crone. I am looking at prepubescent. I am looking at childbearing. I am looking at the woman after the menopause. Why is it called the men? It's hardly fair, isn't it? And you know, this is something I stated in the conference last year. Because, I mean, there were lots of chaps there. I think it bloody would. It's bad enough when a spotty youth finally loses the lumps behind his ears and he realizes it's not for putting holes in donuts. It is so far worse for the lady whose body changes so dramatically.
Thank you so much.
To change so dramatically, all of a sudden, to gladly undergo probably the most hideous pain that anybody... I mean, I was once told by a lady friend of mine, she said, imagine trying to pass a fire brick out of your backside. I thought, right, I'll take your word for it. And if that wasn't enough, later on in life, the horror of having that taken away. This is terrible. We have nothing that compares with this. The only thing that happens to us is brewer's droop. The man has nothing to compare with the trials that undergo the labor. I'm sorry, I'm an enormous champion, but people should bloody understand more. It's Now, I'm going to move us a little bit into Belgium. I'm sorry. No. Oh, yes, we'll do it because we did it on the car down here. Name of famous Belgian. Chocolate. Poirot didn't exist. Oh, very good. The only one I could think of was Egon Rene. And Tintin doesn't exist. Chocolate, I'll give you that. But, I mean, there it is.
Hergé does. Hergé.
See, that sounded a bit French. I am European in all things except French. If you ever are fortunate enough to go to Bruges, or as it's known in Holland, where, as you know, I spend a lot of time in Holland each year, they call it Brugge. One of the loveliest towns it's ever been my fortune to visit. Now, some of you may know Brugge. Put your back to the cafes in the main square, and then look at 2 o'clock, and you will see a strange little ecclesiastical building in the corner of the square. That is the Basilica of the Holy Blood. Now, this is a strange setup, if ever there was one. As you go up, you will see gilded statues along the front. One is a Holy Roman Emperor, one is a Grand Duke of Burgundy, one is his missus, three are Templars, and they are all on the frontage of this building. Now, everybody goes in, and they go upstairs, because upstairs, that's where all the drastic plastic is. Oh, it's all over the place, honestly, it's hideous. It's the epitome of Catholic bad taste. So you know it's going somewhere. As you see this enormous basilica stretching out in front of you, it dates from the early 19th century, because the old one was destroyed in the French Revolution. I need say anything else. And this was built on top of ruins. But there are three things that should cause you interest. Turn to your right and walk in between two pillars, and I'll be coming back to them in a minute, and you're in a little side chapel. And there is this gopping great silver Calvary with this huge cross on top and a little door in the front. You open the door, and there is a crystal tube with brown powder in. And once a week, on a Friday, I think it's 11 o'clock in the morning, they have the procession around, the priests and all the choir boys. And you know there is now a ruling in the Catholic Church. It says, if you must bow or kneel in front of a cardinal, remember to face him. You hold this tube, and you see them holding this crystal tube. And before your eyes, the brown crystals turn to blood. And they have been the guardians of this blood for 1,000 years. And there is a confraternity called the Confraternity of the Sacred Basilica of the Holy Blood. And it was purportedly bought there by Templars. This is absolutely fascinating stuff. So we'll put that back in this ridiculous silver safe. And we'll go back and we're going to look at the two pillars, because they're painted. The one on the left shows Joseph of Arimathea holding a wooden bowl. It's not a cup. Something like that. Just a plain wooden bowl. Rather like the one that is in the hands of a family who I've been told not to mention again. But I didn't know they wanted to be anonymous, you see. I used to tell everybody who the family was. They'd be getting letters from all over the place. So they told me not to, so I can't. And it's so like their bowl. It really is. And that's the bowl that was at Vallecrucis Abbey, and then later kept at Nanteos House in Wales. And then on the next pillar is Mary Magdalene, holding a little green stone cup, like the green stone ointment cup that was found in North Staffordshire when they were actually searching for the relic. But these are much older than anything since the discovery of these relics. Now, that's the modern bit. That's the ooh-ah. That's where you get all these tourists and Mexicans and heavens knows what else coming. They sort of throw themselves down on the floor and they go, for heaven's sake, go out and get laid. if you leave the top part and go down the stairs into the old basilica, that's where the joy is. Look at what's on the walls and facing you. It is tremendous. In front of the altar there, on the wall, you've got the pelican the old pelican in her piety, pecking her breast and feeding her young off her blood. This, everybody said, oh yes, this is a symbol of the Virgin Mary giving up her son. This is a symbol of Christ giving up his life. It's also a symbol of the Magdalene. During the early Middle Ages, this was a very strong symbol. Directly in front of the altar are two tombstones. There are no names on them whatsoever, and they're somewhat shorter than you'd think. They are Templar tombstones, and there are two Templars buried in front of the altar. The only things on the stones, each one has a plain picture of a bowman. Now, inside the tomb, the Templars' heads are removed and placed between their legs and their legs across. Now, you know, I went to public school, you know, and that sort of thing was on the curriculum until you were 15. I actually did a bit of research into this, and this is such a shame. The story goes that at the building of Solomon's Temple, a number of people, villains, three of them, it said, they hijacked Hiram Abiff one night, and he wouldn't give the secrets of the sacred geometry, so they killed him and threw his body in the dungeon until it rotted away, until finally, as it fell about, all of a sudden, out came his skull and two leg bones. Now, this is still the sacred symbol, the skull and crossbones. In case you're wondering about the pirate connection, that's because it was the battle pennant of the Knights Templar. Was actually the skull with two leg bones going underneath it. And when the order was dissolved on the original Friday the 13th, by the orders of the King of France, Philip the Fair, the galleys, the Templar galleys, managed to get away. And they flew their battle standard evermore. And I'm sure all of you have seen Johnny Depp playing Captain Jack Sparrow. It's the wonderful pirate code of, you know, what is it? Take all and give nothing away. That is the Templar code. Accept that which is given, but return nothing. Because that is what happened when you joined the order. Now, one thing was wrong. Hiram Abiff was a historical person, but he didn't die. It was an allegory. It was a story. He lived to a ripe old age. And God knows how many children. And God knows how many wives. He didn't die in the dungeon. He wasn't even set upon by brigands. It was an allegory. No one has quite worked out exactly what that allegory is. But because of this link with the Temple of Jerusalem, the Templars evermore placed their head between their crossed legs in emulation, supposedly, of the death of Hiram Abiff. Now, look to your right when you're down there, and you'll see a tomb. It's a tomb of Christ, and you'll see him lying on the top, dressed in the shroud, and above it in the canopy, you'll find the articles of the crucifixion. But standing on each corner are effigies of grail maidens. And in this chapel downstairs, once a month, it was the nuns who were allowed up to hold the mass as opposed to the confraternity. And they used to hold the mass over towards the tomb where this used to take place. Now, the final picture, look on the wall, and you will see cut into the rock a spearhead with a bow under it and two jugs. One containing water and one containing blood from the piercing of the crucifixion. At the piercing of the crucifixion, who is it carried by? It's not carried by Joseph of Arimathea. He has the bow. The rest is taken out by the mother and Mary Magdalene. It is the women who carry the remnants. It's the female who has the important role all aspects. Now, as far as that thing about the crucifixion is concerned, I'm going to tell you to listen to this podcast thing I did, whatever it is and wherever you find it. You'll find there's a lot of information about that, because there's so much about this crucifixion idea that is pure and utter claptrap. But you've got to bear in mind, and this is important. The Grail story owes its debt of allegiance not to the knight, not to the wounded king, but to the ladies who bear it, not only in the procession, but also in what it does and what it is. I am available for a few minutes to answer some questions. Can I thank most of you for not falling asleep? And thank you so much for spending time with us. Dinas Bran, Valley Crucis Abbey, and the Pillar of Eliseg. If you go to Llangollen, they're all there. Uh-huh. It's all in the town of Llangollen, okay. Which is a lovely place, actually.
Why is that our
domain
is so invested? I mean, he gets Lady Ragnar.
Yes.
He defeats the Green Knight, and he gets the Veil.
He's David Beckham.
He's the medieval Beckham. If they had police sunglasses, he'd be modelling those. And his arm is sponsored by Nike or something. Put your hand up. First one up. Who was Nike?
Thank you. Well done, yes. You know, I go to a lot of schools and they're all wearing Nike and things like this.
Sir, what is your favourite early 80s thrash metal band?
I think if we're looking at the early 80s, I'd be looking probably at Megadeth. My all-time favourite is Rammstein. Sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
With that.
Hope you enjoyed that as much as we did.
Not only does he have some wonderful theories, backed up by such a depth of research, but he's so entertaining in his presentation. And he's quite controversial in places, isn't he?
Oh yes. But he does make it quite clear that all of his opinions are just that, his opinions.
Wonderful. And now to round off our show, we'd like to bring you Dave the Bard's Arthurian masterpiece, The Winter King, from his album, The Spirit of Albion. As without Dave, this talk could never have happened, So thank you so much, Dave.
Facing the west to a distant land, gazing over the sea, standing on Cornwall's rocky shore, the crashing waves far below me. I heard a woman calling my name, her voice, the voice of a friend. She said, now hear me, I'm more than the fae. Let me tell you a story with no end. The life of a man, the life of a king, the love for a queen. Pendragon of Britain, sovereign of the land, the mightiest warrior ever seen. The magic sword in his hand, like lightning cut through the air. Gift of the goddess, lady of the lake, to valiant Arthur the Bear. In the heart of Dumnonia stands a town, an isle on a sea of glass, where Merlin planned the old gods of the land would return to Britain at last. 12 of the 13 treasures were there, Cliff Noithin's cauldron, the quest. On Prydwenae sailed into the other world, number 7 returned from the west. Facing the west to a distant land, gazing over the sea, standing on Cornwall's rocky shore, crashing waves far below me. I see a ship disappear in the mist that shines like silver and bronze, carrying the body of the wounded king to be healed in Avalon. Na 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 na
na na. Was The Winter King by Dave the Bard from his album The Spirit of Albion. Thank you, Dave, for setting all this up. You do so much for the community, and I, for one, really don't know where you find all the time.
No, neither do I. I'm surprised they even recognise him when he walks in his front door. He's away from home so often.
It's true.
Anyway, thank you so much, Dave. And an especial big thank you to the lovely Professor Roland Rotherham for his talk and his permission for us to bring this to you.
And that wraps up this extra special holiday special. And as we're moving into the realms of Welsh mythology, we'd like to say...
Diolch yn fawr.
Back for the first time?
That song was Kellyana, was not. That song was Morgana by Kelly Or... Anglo-Saxon cult. Try that part again. Anglo-Saxon. That song was Morgana by Kellyana. Oh.
Who was it by?
I don't know. Someone I don't know.
You've been listening to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, available from CelticMythPodShow.com.
We hope you've enjoyed the show and will stay tuned for the next episode. You can send us an email or some voice feedback to Gary and Ruth at CelticMythPodShow.com. The show notes for this episode can also be found on the website. We'd like to say a special thank you to Coulan's Hounds, who provided us with the theme music for our show. You can find them at www.sfhounds.com. We'd also like to say a big thank you to Anne Roos, Master Harper, and Keltoria, with a K, Celtic New Age Music, who have both given the show unrestricted access to their music. And thanks again go to Diane Arkinstone and Kim Robertson, whose music has been used as some of the transitions you've heard in this show. You'll find links to all of these wonderful artists in the show notes at shownotes.celticmythpodshow.com.